and welcome to Books of the Year. This is a podcast from your friends at Books of the Year. That's what it is. You already know this because you've downloaded it. Thank you very much.
That is true, but it's always nice to get the intro at the start,
I think. That's right. Yeah. An email from Val Green. Simon and Matt, I listened to David Baldacci on your podcast and had to immediately go and buy Nash Falls as I was so intrigued.
Oh, yes.
The same thing happened with Michael Connelly. I'd never read his books before, but I went straight out and bought Nightshade. Chris Chibnall and Dawn French are now on my TBR list, which grows ever longer, getting very expensive to listen to you. I realize that's true. My reads of the summer have been Whistler by Ann Patchett, which is a simply glorious story, and The Calamity Club by Catherine Stockett, a great story which made me both laugh out loud and genuinely made me a tad teary. This is her first book for years after The Help, and it was worth the wait. Love the pod. Thank you, Val. Thanks for the recommendation.
Excellent. An email from June Richards. All right, lads. Yes, when I type the greeting above, I hear Matt's voice now. Good, good. I have two rules when ordering book titles in my house, says June. Firstly, there is a queue for nonfiction and fiction books waiting to be read. Once my husband and I have read them, they go straight into our community library. However, I have lots of recipe books, and that is where the rules are far more serious and non-negotiable. My 58 wow. recipe books are in alphabetical order and have remained so for many years. Imagine my dismay when many years ago I got home to find not only were my recipe books not in alphabetical order, but their spines had been turned to the wall. My eldest daughter, Melody, had decided it would be a good joke to play. She is now 37 and not allowed near said books.
Yes.
Indeed, quite right. Carry on the great work. I particularly enjoyed the Dawn French episode. So did we.
Okay. Well, Melody, I mean, as a joke, it's not much of a joke.
No, not really. Come on. But 58 recipe books, come on. That feels a little excessive.
Does it feel too much?
There's too many. Yeah.
Okay. You can email us booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. We're on Instagram, Threads, and Blue Sky at Books of the Year. Now we're going to speak to international best-selling author Robert Harris. Well, Matt and I are always very excited when there's a new Robert Harris book around. And guess what? There's a new Robert Harris.
There is, isn't there? Yes. Yes,
and
it's true.
Robert Harris is in our studio. Hello, Robert. How are you?
Hi, Simon. Hi, Matt. I'm very well. Thank you.
It just seems to take forever for you to write a book. Can't you just churn them out like everyone else?
Don't. It's embarrassing. Yet another book. This is 17 novels now. I can't believe it, actually.
Wow.
And is there an excitement still? I mean, as you approach publication date, do you have a certain sense of confidence? Are you still excited by seeing copies of your book in the shops?
Terror, I would say, is the main feeling. Anxiety. But it is exciting. Yes, it is, to see it sort of roll out, something that was, you know, for a long time just very private, just me and the desk, and now it's out there. Yeah, no, I don't think I'll ever get jaded about that.
So the book is called Agrippa. Matt will describe the cover that we're looking at.
Yes, cover shouts out portentous and moody. We have got basically the vast majority of the front cover of the book are storm clouds, and those storm clouds are gathering over one figure on horseback, and it's a Roman general galloping across the bottom of the page with a broken tree on the horizon and some light towards and red and brown tints towards the right-hand side. Robert Harris in big, bold red letters at the top. Agrippa in white, and at the right, at the very top, the number one best-selling author of Conclave.
That was you, I remember.
Yes,
that.
It was.
Yes, I knew.
How long ago was that?
That was a while ago. Now, before we start, I might have said to you before, because you've written about this period before, almost all of my knowledge of this period comes from one, your books, and two, I, Claudius on the television. I grew up watching I, Claudius, and then I read the books by Robert Graves afterwards. So when you write about Augustus, I still see Brian Blessed.
Yeah.
That is a mistake. I have nothing against Brian Blessed, a great actor, but a booming loud presence. And Augustus was nothing like that. He had to wear built-up shoes because he was below average height. He was rather pockmarked face, rather gap-toothed. And he was so, I think, a kind of shy of his appearance that we don't really know what he looked like. I mean, we got the statues that were issued of him were like of a young boy Apollo. And yes, that's all we've got. We don't have any representation of what he really looked like. So, and he was ill an awful lot of the time. We don't know what it was exactly that he had. He shook it off in late middle age, but he missed most of the battles that brought him to power. He was lying groaning in a tent. And that hence Agrippa's importance, because Agrippa, his sort of best and in some ways only friend, was the man who did the fighting.
I just checked the cast list this morning. Derek Jacobi was obviously Claudius. George Baker was Tiberius. Brian Blessed Augustus. John Hurt was Caligula. And James Faulkner was Herod Agrippa. Now, that's not...
No.
That's a different Agrippa.
That's a different Agrippa, and probably... You know, there's dispute really about the name Agrippa, but it's said to have referred to a breech birth. Agrippartum was the Latin, difficult birth. And Agrippa's mother died in childbirth. He was a breech birth. And presumably something like that happened to Herod as well.
All of which is a way of introducing to ask you essentially, what do we know of this man?
Well, in public terms, career, you know, he was consul three times, co-ruler of the Roman world. He built the Pantheon. His name is still above it in Rome. His public career is well known. He founded the Roman fleet, or remodeled it, and beat Antony and Cleopatra at the Battle of Actium. And he was married off to Augustus's niece and to Augustus's daughter, and kind of sired an imperial bloodline that ended with Caligula, his grandson. So those things, the big public things, we know. But he left behind no letters, no speeches, no sayings. He's rather a blank, and to that extent, perfect for a novelist. I mean, he was a man right at the heart of things. He had this 35-year close friendship with Augustus. Without Agrippa, there would have been no Augustus, I don't think. But his inner life is a blank. And so I thought, well, why don't I write his autobiography, his memoirs? And that's the form in which the book is cast.
So let's explore a bit that relationship that he has with Augustus, because they're thrust together, in your book, they're thrust together very early on, as boys, in fact. And we sort of chart the, or certainly Augustus's rise to power, but of Agrippa being right by his side as he does.
Yeah, and this is the first big puzzle about Agrippa. We know that he was the son of a plebeian, he didn't come from any kind of distinguished family or money or anything like that. Yeah, for some reason, he was sent in his early teens to a school for the sons of the Senate and the patricians. And there he encountered the young Octavius, who was the great nephew of Caesar. And whilst the two of them were at school at the age of about 14, Caesar crossed the Rubicon and invaded Italy. We know that Agrippa's father was a follower of Cato and so disapproved of Caesar, and Agrippa's elder brother fought against Caesar in the Civil War. But these two, Agrippa and Octavius the nephew, became very, very close. They both went off to Spain, and Agrippa fought under Julius Caesar. And amazingly, when Caesar sailed back after that victory, he took these two young lads, 16 years old or so, on his flagship, the two of them. And this is a puzzle. Why is Agrippa here, you know? But from then on, he and Octavius were inseparable. They both went off to Apollonia, which is modern Albania, to train with the legions, to join the great campaign in the east that Caesar was contemplating, that he never went on because of the assassination. And news was brought to Apollonia that Caesar's will had been read and Octavius was his heir to take his name and three quarters of his fortune. So these two young lads, by this time Agrippa was 19 and Octavius was 18, they sailed back to Italy, highly dangerous because there were lots of people after the state, and thereafter they're inseparable. And it's a great way, the writing this memoir, fake memoir, of getting inside the huge political turmoil of that time and this very close friendship.
Do soldiers, as you've written this as his memoir, do they write in a different way? Soldiers see the world different to politicians. So we've followed Cicero in your other books. We've visited Pompeii and so on. But soldiers have a particular way of looking at the world. How have you got inside this particular soldier's head?
Well, I tried to imagine what Agrippa was like based on what he did. I mean, your character is often showed by what you do in life. He was a soldier from his teenage years, always a professional soldier, rising to become the supreme general of the Roman legions. He was also brilliant at naval warfare, and it was he who built the fleet that cleared the sea of pirates who were operating from Sicily, and then defeated Antony and Cleopatra off the coast of Greece at Actium. And he was a great civil engineer. I first came across him because he built the aqueduct that is at the heart of Pompeii. And he built other aqueducts in Rome. He built the Pantheon. He was a master builder. So what sort of man is this? It seemed to me supremely practical. An engineer, a soldier, blunt, plain speaking, not at all like Cicero, you know, the other main Roman novel that I've written. He is, I don't think he was particularly philosophical. I don't think he went in for literature. I think that he was a man of action. And that is what I've tried to reflect. To a degree, of course, that's a limiting voice. You know, we're talking about a man thousands of years before Freud. I mean, they didn't really understand psychology in that way. So it's a challenge to write in his voice. One thing I would say is that this is an era of immense cruelty. Augustus, the previously called Octavius, was notorious for his cruelty and savagery, executing people, gouging their eyes out, having fathers put to death in front of their sons, and so on. Nothing like that attaches to Agrippa. And although he was a fearsome soldier, especially putting down the rebellion in Spain, nevertheless, I think he was relatively decent. I don't think he was a psychopath like a lot of them were.
One of the convulsions in the book, when you talk about cruelty, is when you introduce proscription, which I think I might have known something about, but I was coming to this completely cold, really, and what a savage way to proceed your political and military aims. Can you just explain how proscription was used?
Yes. This is like the Roman version of the wealth tax.
It is absolutely that.
Slightly more savage.
Yes, exactly. If you think Burnham's going to give us a rough time, that is as nothing compared. The proscriptions were basically after the Civil War, after Caesar had been killed, and then Mark Antony and Octavius and the Senate had struggled for power, Italy was bankrupt. No one could pay the soldiers that all had to raise the armies. And the three victors, Lepidus, Mark Antony, and Octavius, met in a kind of gangster conclave on a island in the middle of a river with a kind of temporary wooden bridge erected across to it, just them and a couple of aides, and they all patted one another down, searching for concealed weapons beforehand.
Yeah.
And then they set about carving up the world. And you take Gaul, you take Spain, you take Macedonia, and then how do we pay the soldiers? Well, they just drew up a list of everyone who was rich, who they didn't like, and they were to be executed. And it was a really grim business.
So they became enemies of the state.
Yes, you were proscribed. I mean, the most famous person who was proscribed was Cicero, who had previously been assured by Octavius that he was safe. But they sent an initial list of 11 or 12 names to Rome fast so that no one could get away. And Cicero was caught up in that. Then the three men returned to Rome, and then the city gates were closed, and maybe 1,000 or more, mainly senators or equestrians, were killed. There was a price put on their heads, a lot of money, and there were just corpses everywhere. And in this way, they raised the money to pay their soldiers. The whole history of this period is guys desperately trying to raise enough money to keep the soldiers fighting on their side.
And they're normally fighting each other. They're fighting other Romans. I mean, there are battles against, as you say, the Gauls and in Macedonia, and Cleopatra does feature at some point. But mainly, when we're in a battle in this book, we're seeing Roman against Roman.
Yeah, it's the appalling civil war that began when Caesar crossed the Rubicon in 49. And it really goes on for about another 15, 20 years in one form or another. And Agrippa is right in the middle of this.
And this is because, bluntly, the Roman Empire is the superpower, unipolar superpower, which is what we would probably call it these days.
Yes, exactly.
And therefore, that's the only reason why we're having these battles between Romans.
Yes, it's a struggle for mastery of the world. The old constitution of the Republic was all about power sharing. Two consuls, not just one, elected every year to share power, one in one month, one in the next. Strictly limited to a year, magistrates elected. The whole idea of the Roman Republic was to make sure there was no emergence of a super strong man and to share power. Caesar blew that up completely when he crossed the Rubicon, and thereafter they were constantly struggling to see who could come top because the rules had all been torn up. And once the rules had gone, it was simply, you know, who had the most money, who raised the most soldiers. Octavius's great advantage was that he had the name Caesar and that he'd been named in the will as the heir. Mark Antony had control of the state and was the most famous soldier up to that point in Italy. And Lepidus is just a sort of posh nobody, really, in the whole history of the period, a real also-ran.
And you make the point that the commanders of the different armies change sides as easy as they change their clothes. So you end up thinking, why are you fight? What are you fighting about? What is this about? If the commanders swap sides for money, what are they fighting for? Succession?
Succession, really. Power, just as simple as that. There are three of them. And, you know, as we know, three is this two's company, three's a crowd. So it was a constant struggle between the three, making alliances. And in the end, Lepidus was knocked out. And then it was just going to be a contest between Mark Antony, who sort of took over the east of Mediterranean, and Octavius, who had control of the western half of the empire. They tried to come to a deal by a marital alliance that Mark Antony married Octavius's sister. And they had a couple of children together. But Mark Antony was totally infatuated by Cleopatra, and he deserted Octavius's sister in a very public and humiliating fashion. And that was the pretext then for Octavius to go and settle the score with him, with Agrippa at his side.
And as you said, Augustus he's taken control very much as Julius Caesar had taken control. And I'm sure listeners to this podcast are growing heartily sick of me finding parallels to the modern world in historical fiction, but I'm going to do it again, I'm afraid. I make no apology for that. Given we see Augustus deciding to take control of the courts and effectively get rid of democracy, and once again, I see parallels to the modern day. Was that in your mind at all to when you were writing this?
Yes, I mean, you can't escape the parallels. They're not. I mean, obviously, it's a totally different world, and it's a world of armies. You know, it's as if, you know, California was fighting Texas or something, each with their own governors leading an army. So we're not in that kind of state yet. But nevertheless. You know, for many centuries, 300-400 years, I forget exactly, the Romans had this form of democracy with elections and a division of power. Once that went, it became really just the survival of the strongest. Augustus became hugely rich, you know, and it was really about money. You controlled the state, and therefore you controlled the money. And you know, Trump is the first president who is said to have made $2 billion since he's been in office. And the tearing down of all the rules and the blunt and brutal use of power, firing your opponents, going after them, and just the whole display, the cage flight of gladiators on the lawn of the White House, the building of triumphal arches, the putting your name on every building, all of this is very reminiscent of the Romans. And, you know, when you look at the way the world is developing with these hugely rich people, maybe Musk about to become the first trillionaire, you do feel that democracy is going to find it very hard to survive this in the form that we've grown up with, and who knows what the future may hold. The Romans are a great mirror to our own time, and I enjoy writing about them because they're both fascinating in themselves, but they do also tell you something about the basic instincts of people struggling for power.
There's a section which I think is illustrating what Matt's saying. The Senate moved, this is, I'm quoting your book now. The Senate moved on to discuss other business. Nothing more was said about the matter. And in this way, on a quiet winter's afternoon, Rome's ancient republic died without protest, violent overthrow, or fighting in the streets. Most people did not even notice, let alone care. And I thought that was chilling. Not in the way prescription was chilling, which is obviously terrible, lots of terrible things in your book, but the fact that the set of laws and the republic which they supported and had lived through just disappeared without comment, quietly.
Well, one of the very clever things about Augustus, and he was a supremely brilliant politician, if not at all a particularly appealing character, was that he never called himself a king. He called himself the first citizen. He was careful to leave in place all the facade of the old republic. There were still elections. There were still two consuls. There were still magistrates and courts. There was still a Senate. It still held debates. So that a lot of people could fool themselves that the whole thing was just going on as normal and there was a bit of sort of temporary emergency powers behind the scenes. But in fact, they had moved into a monarchy, into an imperial system in which Augustus controlled the key provinces with the main bulk of the army. And he and Agrippa controlled promotions in the army, and you had to be at a certain rank in the army before you could stand for office. So they sort of controlled the whole thing. But you wouldn't have seen it in Rome. It would have looked, if anything, it would have looked a lot better because they had this massive building program. Agrippa was in charge of a lot of it, building baths and aqueducts, fountains, parks, you know, plazas, temples. It was a sort of boom town. And and people didn't really care about the democracy very much at all. You know, bread and circuses in the old phrase. Mm. And you can sort of see how that can happen. I mean, I think there were some chilling polls done here, weren't there, that sort of like 40% of people wouldn't mind, weren't that invested in Parliament, especially young people. Yeah. That, you know, they don't see the point of it. If someone sorts things out, that's really what counts. You know, democracy is very fragile. It hasn't been on the earth very long. I mean, after Caesar put an end to it in Rome, it didn't reappear in the world for 1,700 years.
Mm. Can I ask you about battles, of which obviously Agrippa was a general, so there is a lot of fighting, and all battles are chaos, which it says in the book. Is it a challenge to write chaos?
It is, but I must say, I really enjoyed it. I'm ashamed to say I've never really written battles before. Cicero famously, you know, was no soldier and just a politician. He avoided fighting. But Agrippa, you couldn't get away from it. And so there are some big battles. Munda, in which Julius Caesar was very nearly killed, and Agrippa is actually right by him when he just manages to escape. Philippi, where the assassins of Caesar, Brutus and Cassius, were defeated by Agrippa and Augustus and Mark Antony. And then the great naval set pieces, in particular the Battle of Actium, which is probably one of the key battles in world history. If Octavius and Agrippa had lost that, then the world would have tilted eastwards and the empire would have been run from Alexandria, probably. But as it was, it went the other way. And so the world tilted towards Gaul and the west. So that was hugely important. And they're very, you know, dramatic and fascinating. Naval warfare in particular, which I hadn't really understood how it was done. And I had to learn it. And, you know, I taught myself, really, and enjoyed imagining being on the deck of one of these ships with the oarsmen and the catapults firing and the, you know, I mean, it was a bloody hand-to-hand business.
Distilling all the chaos,
yes,
into a thrilling drama that we follow and are excited by seems to me a real craft, you know, a real kind of huge gift that you have for making this chaotic battle understandable.
Well, thank you. I mean, an Actium of about 400 or 500 ships fighting, and you know, they have tactics. Agrippa, the Antony and Cleopatra's boats were in a kind of in a gulf, in a harbour, and Agrippa drew his fleet up. And they came out, and he kept falling, rowing backwards, really, drawing them further and further out. And then he knew there was a wind that started to blow late morning, and he waited for it, and then he carried forward. And then they sort of charged the line of the others, and so these and enfolded their line around the enemy so that they sort of encircled them. And then it's chaos. Then it's just one boat against another boat. Agrippa introduced new naval tactics. He put collapsible towers onto the decks of these warships with a great kind of catapult at the front, and they would fire a kind of grappling iron attached to a long chain and then a rope that would skim across the water, embed itself in the enemy's boat, and then you'd sort of haul the enemy in and board them. But the battle just evolved into dozens and dozens of skirmishes. And then at an absolutely crucial moment, they sort of saw that the Egyptian fleet, which up to that point had not stirred, was coming out of the harbour. And Agrippa must have thought this was it, the battle was going to turn against him. But instead, Cleopatra's fleet sailed clean through the battle, through a gap in the middle. Mark Antony abandoned the Roman fleet and sailed away with her. Yeah. With all the treasure of Egypt, the entire wealth of the country was on board that fleet. And at that point, the battle was won by Agrippa. But it is, I mean, it's a stunning, stunning day in the history of the world.
Given Agrippa is so, he's formidable, as you say, on land and sea. And given, as you've already pointed out, the number of public works that he was involved in, and these are structures that survive for centuries. How can it be that we know so little about him? You do hint at this in the book or you posit a possible reason for this, but just explore that. How can it be that we don't know that? If I were to go out into the street now, no one would know the word Agrippa.
Well, he was. So these guys are more or less the same age. Agrippa was 6 months older than Octavius. And Octavius was always ill. And quite often it seemed that Agrippa would take over, as he was the sort of designated strongman successor. Mm. But each time Octavius recovered. And then their health sort of in middle age switched. And Octavius lived to be 75. Agrippa died somewhere around his 51st birthday. So that for 25 years, there was only Augustus. And Augustus, as I've said, was very conscious of image. So you only had these heroic statues of him, thousands of them distributed around the Mediterranean. He commissioned writers like Horace and Virgil to great, great patriotic paeans of praise to him. And he built an enormous, hideous mausoleum in Rome where his ashes were to be interred, where 25 years before he died, he interred Agrippa's ashes. And on the entrance to this tomb were giant bronze tablets on which he put his testament to posterity, which he worked on for decades. And it runs in an English translation to 3,500 words. And the word Agrippa occurs twice in passing. Yeah. So he was sort of quite consciously written out of the record. It reminds one of Stalin or Mao or one of these totalitarian rulers, and they just demand all the attention. He features Agrippa in, you know, the contemporary histories, or more or less contemporary histories of the period, but we just don't know much about him. And it's astonishing to think there's no speech or no letter or anything from a man who was really the co-ruler of the Roman world. So I think he was, to a degree, expunged from history. And then there's this business about his origins. Mm. Everything goes back to that. As I said, he was married off by Augustus, who, like his great uncle, didn't seem able to father a legitimate male child. He only had one daughter, Julia. And he married Agrippa, his friend, to his daughter. And despite the gap in ages between them, and they did have, I think, five children, three of them boys, and these, the elder two were immediately adopted by Augustus as his children. Yeah. He sort of took them off Agrippa and said, these are mine. And I think that the fact that Agrippa's origins were plebeian was an embarrassment to this imperial family, possibly. Or there is another theory, which I entertain in the book, that it's just possible Agrippa might have been the illegitimate son of Julius Caesar.
Wow.
The dates fit. He was in Rome in the year before Agrippa was born. Agrippa's mother died in childbirth. It would explain why someone paid and arranged for him to go to this expensive school, why he then joined the army at the same time as Octavius, why they went to Spain together, why Caesar brought them back together on his flagship, why he sent them off to Apollonia together. And it would explain also, although, of course, we know that life doesn't work like this, but it would explain where this military and organizational genius came in that Agrippa had. I mean, he was one in, you know, half a million kind of a man. And did it just come from nowhere? So there's some reason, and I can only speculate, but that's what I can do in a novel, because in a novel you're allowed speculation and historians simply can't do it.
It's another unmissable book from Robert Harris. It is called Agrippa. Is it a thriller? No, it's Agrippa.
First to say that. I've been waiting for someone to say it, and I'm going to give you a small cash prize.
Thank you. You can put it on the... Do you know what you're writing next, Robert? Have you started already?
No, I've got a vague idea, which I'm thinking of, but, you know, I'm quite exhausted, actually.
Is it science fiction?
It's not a rom-com either.
No. Okay, all right, just check. You'll hear more with Robert in our Q&A in a couple of days' time. But for the moment, Robert Harris, thank you very much.
Thank you. Good to talk to you again.